This is Audible.
Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. Read by Mel Hudson. Part 1. Genesis. Chapter 1.1. Just a Barrel of Monkeys. There were no windows in the Bryn 2 facility. Rotation meant that outside was always down, underfoot, out of mind. The wall screens told a pleasant fiction, a composite view of the world below that ignored their constant spin, showing the planet as hanging stationary still off in space, the green marble to match the blue marble of home, 20 light-years away. Earth had been green in her day, though her colours had faded since. Perhaps never as green as this beautifully crafted world, though, where even the oceans glittered emerald with the phytoplankton maintaining the oxygen balance within its atmosphere. How delicate and many-sided was the task of building a living monument that would remain stable for geological ages to come. It had no officially confirmed name beyond its astronomical designation, although there was a strong vote for Simiana amongst some of the less imaginative crew members. Dr. Avrana Kern now looked out upon it and thought only of Kern's world. Her project, her dream, her planet, the first of many, she decided. This is the future. This is where mankind takes its next great step. This is where we become gods. This is the future, she said aloud. Her voice would sound in every crew member's auditory centre, all 19 of them, though 15 were right here in the control hub with her. Not the true hub, of course. The gravity-denuded axle about which they revolved, that was for power and processing, and their payload. This is where mankind takes its next great step. Her speech had taken more of her time than any technical details over the last 2 days. She almost went on with the line about them becoming gods. But that was for her only. Far too controversial, given the non-ultra natura clowns back home. Enough of a stink had been raised over projects like hers already. Oh, the differences between the current Earth factions went far deeper. Social, economic, or simply us and them. But Kern had got the Bryn launched all those years ago against mounting opposition. By now, the whole idea had become a kind of scapegoat for the divisions of the human race. Bickering primates, the lot of them. Progress is what matters. Fulfilling the potential of humanity. And of all other life. She had always been one of the fiercest opponents of the growing conservative backlash most keenly exemplified by the non-ultra-natura terrorists. If they had their way, we'd all end up back in the caves, back in the trees. The whole point of civilization is that we exceed the limits of nature, you tedious little primitives. We stand on others' shoulders, of course. The proper line, that of accepted scientific humility, was on the shoulders of giants. But she had not got where she was by bowing the knee to past generations. Midgets. Lots and lots of midgets, she thought, and then she could barely keep back the appalling giggle. On the shoulders of monkeys. At a thought from her, one wall screen and their mind's eye HUDs displayed the schematics of Bryn 2 for them all. She wanted to direct their attention and lead them along with her towards the proper appreciation of her, sorry, their, triumph. There, the needle of the central core, encircled by the ring of life and science, that was their torus-shaped world. At one end of the core was the unlovely bulge of the Sentry Pod, soon to be cast adrift to become the universe's loneliest and longest research post. The opposite end of the needle sported the barrel and the flask. Contents? Monkeys and the future, respectively. Particularly, I have to thank the engineering teams under Doctors Fallon and Meddy for their tireless work in reformatting. And she almost now said Kern's world without meaning to, our subject planet, to provide a safe and nurturing environment for our great project. Fallon and Mehdi were well on their way back to Earth, of course. Their 15-year work completed, their 30-year return journey begun. It was all stage-setting, though, to make way for Kern and her dream. We are, I am, what all this work is for. A journey of 20 light-years home. Whilst 30 years drag by on Earth, only 20 will pass for Fallon and Mehdi in their cold coffins. For them, their voyage is nearly as fast as light. What wonders we can accomplish. From her viewpoint, engines to accelerate her to most of the speed of light were no more than pedestrian tools to move her about a universe that Earth's biosphere was about to inherit. Because humanity may be fragile in ways we cannot dream, so we cast our net wide and then wider. Human history was balanced on a knife edge. Millennia of ignorance, prejudice, superstition, and desperate striving had brought them at last to this, that humankind would beget new sentient life in its own image. Humanity would no longer be alone. Even in the unthinkably far future, when Earth itself had fallen in fire and dust, there would be a legacy spreading across the stars, an infinite and expanding variety of Earth-born life, diverse enough to survive any reversal of fortune until the death of the whole universe, and perhaps even beyond that. Even if we die, we will live on in our children. Let the NUNs preach their dismal all-eggs-in-one-basket creed of human purity and supremacy, she thought. We will out-evolve them. We will leave them behind. This will be the first of 1,000 worlds that we will give life to. For we are gods, and we are lonely, so we shall create. Back home, things were tough, or so the 20-year-old images indicated. Avrana had skimmed dispassionately over the riots, the furious debates, the demonstrations and violence, thinking only, how did we ever get so far with so many fools in the gene pool? The non-ultra natura lobby were only the most extreme of a whole coalition of human political factions, the conservative, the philosophical, even the die-hard religious, who looked at progress and said that enough was enough, who fought tooth and nail against further engineering of the human genome, against the removal of limits on AI, and against programs like Avrana's own. And yet, they're losing. The terraforming would still be going on elsewhere. Kern's world was just one of many planets receiving the attentions of people like Fallon and Mehdi, transformed from inhospitable chemical rocks, Earth-like only in approximate size and distance from the sun, into balanced ecosystems that Kern could have walked on without a suit in only minor discomfort. After the monkeys had been delivered, and the sentry pod detached to monitor them, those other gems were where her attention would next be drawn. We will seed the universe with all the wonders of Earth. In her speech, which she was barely paying attention to, she meandered down a list of other names from here or at home. The person she really wanted to thank was herself. She had fought for this. Her engineered longevity allowing her to carry the debate across several natural human lifetimes. She had clashed in the financiers' rooms and in the laboratories, at academic symposiums and on mass entertainment feeds, just to make this happen. I have done this. With your hands have I built. With your eyes have I measured. But the mind is mine alone. Her mouth continued along its prepared course, the words boring her even more than they presumably bored her listeners. The real audience for this speech would receive it in 20 years' time. The final confirmation back home of the way things were due to be. Her mind touched base with the Bryn 2's hub. Confirm barrel systems. She pinged into her relay link with the facility's control computer. It was a check that had become a nervous habit of late. With intolerance, it replied. And if she probed behind that bland summary, she would see precise readouts of the lander craft, its state of readiness, even down to the vital signs of its 10,000-strong primate cargo, the chosen few who would inherit, if not the Earth, then at least this planet, whatever it would be called. Whatever they would eventually call it, once the uplift nanovirus had taken them that far along the developmental road. The biotechs estimated that a mere 30 or 40 monkey generations would bring them to the stage where they might make contact with the sentry pod and its lone human occupant. Alongside the barrel was the flask, the delivery system for the virus that would accelerate the monkeys along their way. They would stride, in a mere century or two, across physical and mental distances that had taken humanity millions of long and hostile years. Another group of people to thank, for she herself was no biotech specialist. She had seen the specs and the simulations, though, and expert systems had examined the theory and summarised it in terms that she, a mere polymath genius, could understand. The virus was clearly an impressive piece of work, as far as she could grasp it. Infected individuals would produce offspring mutated in a number of useful ways. Greater brain size and complexity, greater body size to accommodate it, more flexible behavioural paths, swifter learning. The virus would even recognise the presence of infection in other individuals of the same species, so as to promote selective breeding, the best of the best giving birth to even better. It was a whole future in a microscopic shell, almost as smart, in its single-minded little way, as the creatures that it would be improving. It would interact with the host genome at a deep level, replicate within its cells like a new organelle, passing itself onto the host's offspring until the entire species was subject to its benevolent contagion. No matter how much change the monkeys underwent, that virus would adapt and adjust to whatever genome it was partnered with, analysing and modelling and improvising with whatever it inherited, until something had been engineered that could look its creators in the eye and understand. She had sold it to the people back home by describing how colonists would reach the planet then, descending from the skies like deities to meet their new people. Instead of a harsh, untamed world, a race of uplifted, sentient aides and servants would welcome their makers. That was what she had told the boardrooms and the committees back on Earth. But it had never been the point of the exercise for her. The monkeys were the point, and what they would become. This was one of the things the NUNs were most incensed about. They shouted about making super beings out of mere beasts. In truth, like spoiled children, it was sharing that they objected to. Only child humanity craved the sole attention of the universe. Like so many other projects hoisted as political issues, the virus's development had been fraught with protests, sabotage, terrorism, and murder. And yet, we triumph over our own base nature at last, Kern reflected with satisfaction. And of course, there was a tiny grain of truth to the insults the NUNs threw her way, because she didn't care about colonists or the neo-imperialistic dreams of her fellows. She wanted to make new life, in her image as much as in humanity's. She wanted to know what might evolve, what society, what understandings, when her monkeys were left to their own simian devices. To Avrana Kern, this was her price, her reward for exercising her genius for the good of the human race. This experiment, this planetary what-if. Her efforts had opened up a string of terraformed worlds, but her price was that the firstborn would be hers, and home to her new-made people. She was aware of an expectant silence, and realised that she'd got to the end of her speech, and now everyone thought she was just adding gratuitous suspense to a moment that needed no gilding. "Mr. Sering, are you in position?" she asked on open channel for everyone's benefit. Sering was the volunteer, the man they were going to leave behind. He would orbit their planet-sized laboratory as the long years turned, locked in cold sleep, until the time came for him to become mentor to a new race of sentient primates. She almost envied him, for he would see and hear and experience things that no other human ever had. He would be the new Hanuman, the monkey god. Almost envied, but in the end, Kern rather preferred to be departing to undertake other projects. Let others become gods of mere single worlds, she herself would stride the stars and head up the pantheon. I am not in position. No. And apparently he felt that was also deserving of a wider audience, because he had broadcast it on the general channel. Kern felt a stab of annoyance. I cannot physically do everything myself. Why is it that other people so often fail to meet my standards when I rely on them? To Sering alone, she sent, Perhaps you would explain why?
I was hoping to be able to say a few words, Dr. Kern.
It would be his last contact with his species for a long time, she knew, and it seemed appropriate. If he could make a good showing, then it would only add to her legend. She held ready on the master comms, though, setting him on a few seconds' delay, just in case he became maudlin or started saying something inappropriate.
This is a turning point in human history.
Sering's voice, always slightly mournful, came to her, and then through her to everyone else. His image was in their mind's eye HUDs, with the collar of his bright orange environment suit done up high to the chin.
I had to think long and hard before committing myself to this course, as you can imagine. But some things are too important. Sometimes you have to just do the right thing, whatever the cost.
Kern nodded, pleased with that.
Be a good monkey and finish up soon, Sering. Some of us have legacies to build.
We have come so far, and still we fall into the oldest errors, Sering continued doggedly.
We're standing here, with the universe in our grasp, and instead of furthering our own destinies, we connive at our own obsolescence.
Her attention had drifted a little, and by the time she realized what he had said, the words had passed on to the crew. She registered suddenly a murmur of concerned messages between them, and even simple spoken words whispered between those closest to her. Dr. Mercian, meanwhile, sent her an alert on another channel.
Why is Sering in the engine core?
Sering should not be in the engine core of the needle. Sering should be in the sentry pod, ready to take his place in orbit and in history. She cut Sering off from the crew and sent him an angry demand to know what he thought he was doing. For a moment, his avatar stared at her in her visual field. Then it lip-synced to his voice.
You have to be stopped, Dr. Kern. You and all your kind. Your new humans. New machines. New species. If you succeed here, then there will be other worlds. You've said so yourself, and I know they're terraforming them even now. It ends here. Non ultra natura. No greater than nature.
She wasted vital moments of potential dissuasion by resorting to personal abuse until he spoke again.
I've cut you off, Doctor. Do the same to me if you wish, but for now I'm going to speak, and you don't get to interrupt me.
She was trying to override him, hunting through the control computer's systems to find what he had done, but he had locked her out elegantly and selectively. There were whole areas of the facility's systems that just did not appear on her mental schematic, and when she quizzed the computer about them, it refused to acknowledge their existence. None of them was mission critical. Not the barrel, not the flask, not even the sentry pod. Therefore none were the systems she had been obsessively checking every day. Not mission critical, perhaps, but facility critical.
He's disabled the reactor safeties, Mercian reported. What's going on? Why is he in the engine core at all?
Alarm, but not outright panic, which was a good finger in the air for the mood of the crew all around.
He's in the engine core because his death will be instant and total, and therefore probably painless, Kern surmised.
She was already moving, to the surprise of the others. She was heading up, climbing into the access shaft that led to the slender central pylon of the station, heading away from the outer floor that remained down only so long as she was close to it. Climbing up, out of that spurious gravity well, towards the long needle they all revolved around. There was a flurry of increasingly concerned messages. Voices called out at her heels. Some of them would follow her, she knew. Sering was continuing blithely.
"This is not even the beginning, Dr. Kern."
His tone was relentlessly deferential, even in rebellion.
"Back home, it will have already started. Back home, it is probably already over. In another few years, maybe, you'll hear that Earth and our future have been taken back for the humans. No uplifted monkeys, Dr. Kern. No godlike computers. No freak shows of the human form. We'll have the universe to ourselves, as we were intended to, as was always our destiny. On all the colonies, in the solar system and out, our agents will have made their move. We will have taken power, with the consent of the majority. You understand, Dr. Kern."
And she was lighter and lighter, hauling herself towards an up that was becoming an in. She knew she should be cursing Sering, but what was the point if he would never hear her? It was not such a long way to the weightlessness of the needle's hollow interior. She had her choice then, either towards the engine core, where Sering had no doubt taken steps to ensure that he would not be disturbed, or away. Away in a very final sense. She could override anything Sering had done. She had full confidence in the superiority of her abilities. It would take time, though. If she cast herself that way, down the needle, towards Sering and his traps and locked barriers, then time would be something she would not have the benefit of.
"And if the powers that be refuse us, Dr. Kern,"
that hateful voice continued in her ear,
"then we will fight. If we must wrest mankind's destiny back by force, then we shall."
She barely took in what he was saying, but a cold sense of fear was creeping into her mind, not from the danger to her and the Brin too, but what he was saying about Earth and the colonies. A war? Impossible. Not even the NUNs. But it was true there had been some incidents. Assassinations, riots, bombs. The whole of Europa base had been compromised. The NUNs were spitting into the inevitable storm of manifest destiny, though. She had always believed that. Such outbursts represented the last throes of humanity's under-evolvers. She was now heading the other way, distancing herself from the engine core, as though the Brin had enough space within it for her to escape the coming blast. She was utterly rational, however. She knew exactly where she was going. Ahead of her was the circular portal to the sentry pod. Only on seeing it did she realise that some part of her mind, the part she always relied on to finesse the more complex calculations, had already fully understood the current situation and discerned the one, slim but possible, way out. This was where Sering was supposed to be. This was the slow boat to the future that he, in a sane timeline, would have been piloting. Now she ordered the door to open, relieved to discover that this, the one piece of equipment that was actually his particular business, seemed to have remained free of Sering's meddling. The first explosion came, and she thought it was the last one. The Brin creaked and lurched around her, but the engine core remained stable, as evidenced by the fact that she herself had not been disintegrated. She tuned back into the wild whirl of frantic messaging between the crew. Sering had rigged the escape pods. He didn't want anyone avoiding the fate he had decreed for himself. Had he somehow forgotten the sentry pod? The detonating pods would push the Brin 2 out of position, drifting either towards the planet or off into space. She had to get clear. The door opened at her command, and she had the sentry hub run a diagnostic on the release mechanism. There was so little space inside, just the cold sleep coffin. Don't think of it as a coffin. And the termini of its associated systems. The hub was querying her. She was not the right person, nor was she wearing the proper gear for prolonged cold sleep. "But I don't intend to be here for centuries, just long enough to ride it out." She swiftly overrode its quibbles, and by that time the diagnostics had pinpointed Sering's tampering, or rather identified, by process of elimination, those parts of the release process that he had erased from its direct notice. Sounds from outside suggested that the best course of action was to order the door closed, and then lock the systems, so that nobody from outside could intrude on her. She climbed into the cold sleep tank, and around that time, The banging started. Those others of the crew who had come to the same realization as her, but slightly later. She blocked out their messaging. She blocked out Sering, too, who was obviously not going to tell her anything useful now. It was better if she didn't have to share her head with anyone except the hub control systems. She had no idea how much time she had, but she worked with the trademark balance of speed and care that had got her where she was now. Got me leading the Bryn 2 facility, and got me here in the sentry pod. What a clever, doomed monkey I am. The muffled banging was more insistent, but the pod only had room for one. Her heart had always been hard, but she found that she had to harden it still further, and not think of all those names and faces, her loyal colleagues, that she and Sering between them were condemning to an explosive end. "Which I myself have not yet escaped," she reminded herself. And then she had it. A workaround, jury-rigged release path that avoided Sering's ghost systems. Would it work? She had no opportunity for a dry run, nor had she any other options. Nor, she suspected, any time. "Release," she ordered the hub, and then shouted down all of the different ways it was programmed to ask, "Are you sure?" until she felt the movement of mechanisms around her. Then it wanted her to go into cold sleep immediately, as had been the plan, but she made it wait. If the captain was not going down with her ship, she would at least watch its demise from a distance. And how much distance would that need? There were by then several thousand messages clamouring for her attention. Every member of the crew wanted to talk to her, but she had nothing to say to any of them. The sentry pod had no windows either. Had she wanted, it could have shown her a HUD display of the rapidly receding Bryn 2 as her little capsule of life fell into its prearranged orbit. Now she returned to the Bryn's systems, her internal comms boosted by the sentry hub, and instructed it, "Launch the barrel." She wondered if it was just poor timing, but in retrospect that had probably been Sering's first and more carefully performed task. Subtle enough to slip by in all her checks, because of course the actual mechanical release for flask and barrel was virtually beneath her notice. "On the shoulders of others," she had said, but she had not stopped to think about those beneath her in that pyramid of achievement. Even the lowliest of them had to agree to bear her weight, or all of it would come falling down. She saw the flare, not even in her mind's eye, but through the brief flower of damage reports from the Bryn 2's computers, as all of her colleagues and her facility, and Sering the traitor, and all of her work, became abruptly no more than a rapidly disassociating cloud of fragments, a ghost breath of dissipating atmosphere, with some unrecognizable organic remains. "Correct course and stabilize." She had been expecting a shockwave, but the sentry pod was already far enough away, and the Bryn 2's energy and matter were so minuscule compared to the distances involved that barely any adjustment was required to ensure the sentry pod remained within its programmed orbit. "Show me." She braced herself for the image. But really, at this remove, it seemed almost nothing. A flash, a tiny burned boat of all her ideas and friends. In the final analysis, it had all been nothing more than a barrel of over-evolved monkeys, after all. From this distance, against the vast and heedless backdrop of everything else, it was hard to say why any of it had ever mattered at all. "Distress beacon," she ordered, because they would need to know, on Earth, what had happened. They had to know that they must come and collect her, wake her like Sleeping Beauty, after all. She was Dr. Kern. She was the future of the human race, right here. They needed her. 20 long years for her signal to reach Earth. Far more than that for the rescue to come back, even with the best fusion engines employed to accelerate to 3/4 light speed. But her frail body would survive that long in cold sleep, and more than that. Some hours later, she saw the end of it. She saw the barrel hit atmosphere. It was not on the planned trajectory, the conflagration of the Bryn 2 having sent it off on a tangent so that it narrowly avoided being hurled forever into empty space. Its cargo would not care, in the long run. The barrel burned, streaking like a meteor through the atmosphere of the green world. Somehow, The thought of the insensate terror that its primate occupants must be going through, as they died in ignorance, by fear and burning, touched her more than the death of her fellow humans. And wouldn't Sering claim that as evidence that he was right? From force of habit, a redundant professional thoroughness, she located the flask, watching as the smaller canister fell through the atmosphere at a gentler angle, delivering its viral cargo to a world devoid of the simians it was intended for. We can always get more monkeys. That was a curious mantra, but it made her feel better. The uplift virus would last for millennia. The project would survive the treachery and death of its creators. She herself would ensure it. Listen for a change in radio signals. Wake me when you hear it, she instructed. The pod computer was not happy about that. It required more exacting parameters. Kern thought over all the developments back home she might want to be appraised of. Listing them all was tantamount to trying to predict the future. Then give me options. The HUD streamed with possibilities. The pod computer was a sophisticated piece of engineering, complex enough that it could feign sentience, if not quite own to it. Upload facility, she noted. It was not the most pleasant thought in the world, but was she not always saying how much easier life would be if she could arrange everything herself? The pod could upload an image of her consciousness into itself. Albeit an imperfect copy, it would form a Kern computer composite that would be able to react to external events in a simulation of her own best judgment. She scanned through the caveats and notes. More cutting-edge technology that they were due to have pioneered. Over time, it was predicted that the AI network would further incorporate the uploaded Kern so that the composite would be able to make finer and finer distinctions. Potentially, the end result would be something smarter and more capable than the simple sum total of human and machine combined. Do it, she instructed, lying back and waiting for the pod to begin scanning her brain. Just let them be quick with the rescue party. Chapter 1.2 Brave Little Huntress. She is Portia, and she is hunting. She is 8 millimeters long, but she is a tiger within her tiny world, fierce and cunning. Like all spiders, she has a body of two parts. Her small abdomen holds her book lungs and the bulk of her gut. Her head body is dominated by two huge eyes facing forwards for perfect binocular vision beneath a pair of tiny tufts that crown her like horns. She is fuzzy, with hair in broken patterns of brown and black. To predators, she looks more dead leaf than live prey. She waits. Below her formidable eyes, her fangs are flanked by limb-like mouthparts, her palps, coloured a startling white like a quivering moustache. Science has named her Portia labiata, just another unassuming species of jumping spider. Her attention is fixed on another spider at home in its web. This is Cytodes pallida, longer-limbed and hunchbacked, and able to spit toxic webbing. Cytodes specialises in catching and eating jumping spiders like Portia. Portia specialises in eating spider-eating spiders, most of whom are larger and stronger than she. Her eyes are remarkable. The visual acuity of a primate peers out from those pinhead-sized discs and the flexible chambers behind them, piecing together the world around her. Portia has no thoughts. Her 60,000 neurons barely form a brain, contrasted with a human's 100 billion. But something goes on in that tiny knot of tissue. She has already recognised her enemy, and knows its spit will make any frontal assault fatal. She has been playing with the edge of the Cytodes' web, sending tactile lies to it of varying shades to see if it can be lured out. The target has twitched once or twice, but it will not be deceived. This is what a few tens of thousands of neurons can do. Portia has tried and failed, variation after variation, homing in on those that evinced the most response, and now she will go about things differently. Her keen eyes have been examining the surroundings of the web, the branches and twigs that hang over and below it. Somewhere, in her little knot of neurons, a three-dimensional map has been built up from her meticulous scrutiny, and she has plotted a painstaking course to where she may come at the Cytodes from above, like a minute assassin. The approach is not perfect, but it is the best the environment will allow, and her scrap of brain has worked all this out as a theoretical exercise ahead of time. The planned approach will take her out of sight of her prey for much of the journey, but even when her prey is beyond view, it will remain in her tiny mind. If her prey was something other than Cytodes, then she would have different tactics, or would experiment until something worked. It usually does. Portia's ancestors have been making these calculations and decisions for millennia, each generation fractionally more accomplished, because the best hunters are the ones that eat well and lay more eggs. So far, so natural, and Portia is just about to set off on her quest when movement attracts her gaze. Another of her species has arrived, a male. He has also been studying the Cytodes, but now his acute eyes are locked on her. Past individuals of her species might have decided that the little male was a safer lunch than the Cytodes and made plans accordingly. But now something changes. The presence of the male speaks to her. It is a complex, new experience. The crouching figure there at the far side of the Cytodes' web is not just prey, mate, irrelevant. There is an invisible connection strung between them. She does not quite grasp that he is something like her, but her formidable ability to calculate strategies has gained a new dimension. A new category appears that expands her options a hundredfold. Ally. For long minutes, the two hunting spiders examine their mental maps, while the Cytodes hangs patiently oblivious between them. Then Portia watches the male creep around the web's edge a little. He waits for her to move. She does not. He moves again. At last, he has got to where his presence changes her instinctive calculation of the odds. She moves off along the course that she had been plotting out, creeping, jumping, descending by a thread, and all the while, her mind retains its image of that three-dimensional world and the two other spiders inside it. At last, she is in position above the Cytodes' web, back in sight of the motionless male. She waits until he makes his move. He skitters onto the silken strands, cautiously testing his footing. His movements are mechanical, repetitive, as though he is just some fragment of dead leaf that has drifted into the web. The Cytodes shifts once, then remains still. A breeze shivers the web, and the male moves more swiftly under cover of the white noise of the shaking strands. He bounces and dances abruptly, speaking the language of the web in loud and certain terms. Prey! Prey here! Trying to escape! The Cytodes is instantly on the move, and Portia strikes, dropping down behind her displaced enemy and sinking her fangs into it. Her poison immobilizes the other spider swiftly. The hunt is concluded. Soon after, the little male returns, and they regard one another, trying to build a new picture of their world. They feed. She is constantly on the verge of driving him away, and yet that new dimension, that commonality, stays her fangs. He is prey. He is not prey. Later, they hunt together again. They make a good team. Together, they are able to take on targets and situations that alone either would have retreated from. Eventually, he is promoted from prey, not prey, to mate, because her behaviours are limited as regards males. After the act of mating, other instincts surface, and their partnership comes to an end. She lays her clutch, the many eggs of a very successful huntress. Their children will be beautiful and brilliant, and grow to twice her size, infected with the nanovirus that Portia and the male both carry. Further generations will be larger and brighter and more successful still, one after the other selectively evolving at a virally accelerated rate, so that those best able to exploit this new advantage will dominate the gene pool of the future. Portia's children will inherit the world. Chapter 1.3. The Lights Go Out. Dr. Avrana Kern awoke to a dozen complex feeds of information, none of which helped her restore her memories of what had just happened, or why she was groggily returning to consciousness in a cold sleep unit. She could not open her eyes. Her entire body was cramping, and there was nothing in her mental space except the overkill of information assailing her, every system of the sentry pod clamouring to report. "Eliza mode," she managed to instruct, feeling queasy, bloated, constipated and overstimulated all at once, as the machinery of the coffin laboured to bring her back to something resembling active life. "Good morning, Dr. Kern," said the sentry hub in her auditory centres. It had assumed a woman's voice, strong and reassuring. Kern was not reassured. She wanted to ask why she was here in the sentry pod, but she could feel the answer continually just about to hit her and never quite landing. "Just give me something to get my memories back together," she ordered. "That is not recommended," the hub cautioned her. "If you want me to make any kind of decision..." And then everything fell back into her head in pieces, dams breaking to unleash a flood of horrifying revelation. The Brin, too, was gone. Her colleagues were gone. The monkeys were gone. Everything was lost, except her. And she had told the hub to wake her when the radio signals came. She took what was intended to be a deep breath, but her chest would not work properly, and she just wheezed. "About time," she told the hub, for all that statement would be meaningless to the computer. Now it was talking to her, she instinctively felt she should converse with it as though it was human. This had always been a vexing side effect of the Eliza mode. "How much time has elapsed? Earth standard?"
14 years and 72 days, Doctor.
"That's..." She felt her throat open a little. "That can't be..." No point telling a computer it couldn't be right. But it wasn't right. It wasn't long enough. Word couldn't have got back to Earth and a rescue ship arrived in that time. But then the hope set in. Of course a ship had already been heading for her before Sering destroyed the Brin too. No doubt the man's status as an NUN agent had been uncovered long before, when their ridiculous uprising had failed. She was saved. Surely she was saved. "Initiate contact," she told the hub. "I'm afraid that is not possible, Doctor." She tutted and called up the system's feeds again, feeling better able to cope with them. Each part of the pod opened for her, confirming its working order. She checked the comms. Receivers were within tolerance. Transmitters were working, sending out her distress signal, and also performing their primary function, broadcasting a complex set of messages to the planet below. Of course, it had been intended that some day that same planet would become the cradle to a new species that might receive and decode those messages. No chance of that now.
"It's all..."
Her croaky voice infuriated her.
"Clarify. What's the problem?"
"I'm afraid that there is nothing to initiate contact with, Doctor," the hub's Eliza mode told her politely. Her attention was then directed to a simulation of space surrounding them. Planet. Sentry hub. No ship from Earth.
"Explain."
"There has been a change in radio signals, Doctor. I require a command decision as to its significance, I'm afraid."
"Will you stop saying I'm afraid?"
she rasped angrily.
"Of course, Doctor."
And it would, she knew. That particular mannerism would be barred from its speech from that moment on.
"Since you entered cold sleep, I have been monitoring signals from Earth."
"And?"
But Kern's voice shook a little. "Sering mentioned a war. Has there been news of a war? And on the heels of that, would the hub even know to wake me? It wouldn't be able to filter for content like that. So what?" It had been there, lost amid the profusion of data, but the hub highlighted it now. Not a presence, but an absence. She wanted to ask it, "What am I looking at?" She wanted to tell it that it was wrong again, She wanted it to double-check, as though it was not checking every single moment. There were no more radio signals from Earth. The last trailing edge of them had passed the sentry pod by, and radiating out from Earth at the speed of light, were already out of date by 20 years, as they fled past her into the void.
"I want to hear the final 12 hours of signals."
She had thought that there would be too many of them. But they were few, scattered, encoded. Those she could interpret were pleas for help. She tracked them back another 48 hours, trying to piece it all together. The hub's rolling recorder had retained no more than that. The precise details were already lost, speeding away from her faster than she could possibly pursue. Sering's war had broken out, though. That was all she could think. It had come and begun snuffing out colonies across human space. The lights had gone out across the solar system as the NUNs and their allies rose up and wrestled with their enemies for the fate of mankind. That there had been an escalation seemed incontrovertible. Kern was well aware that the governments of Earth and the colonies possessed weapons of terrifying potential, and the theoretical science existed for far worse. The war on Earth had gone hot, that much she could tell. Neither side had backed down. Both sides had pushed and pushed, pulling new toys from the box. The beginnings of the war were lost from her 2.5-day radio window, but she had the dreadful suspicion that the entire global conflict had lasted less than a week. And now, 20 light-years away, Earth lay silent, had lain silent for 2 decades. Were there people there at all? Had the entire human race been exterminated save for her? Or had it simply been thrown back into a new dark age, where the dumb brute people looked up at those moving lights in the sky and forgot that their ancestors had built them? The stations, the insular colonies, the others, she got out. One of the last transmissions from Earth was an all-frequencies, all-directions electronic virus, Doctor, Eliza reported dolorously. Its purpose was to infest and disable any system that received it. It appears that it was able to penetrate known security. I surmise that the various colony systems have all been shut down. But that means... Avrana already felt as cold as any human could have. She waited for the chill of realization, but there was none. The insolar colonies and the handful of extrasolar bases were still being terraformed. They had been built early on in mankind's space-going history, and after the technology had been developed, the extensive presence of human settlements there had slowed the process down. So many individual toes to tread on. Tabula rasa planets were so much swifter, and Kern's world was the very first of these to be completed. Beyond Earth, mankind was terribly, terribly reliant on its technology, on its computers. If such a virus had taken over the systems on Mars or Europa and disabled those systems, that meant death. Swift death. Cold death. Airless death.
How did you survive, then? How did we survive?
Doctor, the virus was not designed to attack experimental, uploaded human personality constructs. Your presence within my systems has prevented me being a suitable host for the virus. Avrana Kern stared past the lights of her HUD, at the darkness inside the sentry pod, thinking about all the places in the greater dark beyond where humanity had once made a fragile, eggshell home for itself. In the end, all she could think of to ask was,
"Why did you wake me?"
"I require you to make a command decision, Doctor."
"What command decision could you possibly need now?"
she asked the computer acidly. "It will be necessary for you to return to cold sleep," the hub told her, and now she bitterly missed the "I'm afraid," which had added a much-needed sense of human hesitancy. "However, a lack of information concerning current external circumstances means that I'm likely to be unable to determine an appropriate trigger to reawaken you. I also believe that you yourself may not be able to instruct me concerning such a trigger, although you may give me any instructions you wish, or alternatively, simply specify a particular period of time. In the alternative, You may simply rely on your personality upload to wake you at the appropriate time. The unspoken echo of that sounded in her mind. Or never. There may never be a time. Show me the planet. The great green orb that she spun about was produced for her, and all its measurements and attributes, each linking to a nested tree of additional details. Somewhere in there were the credits, the names of the dead who had designed and built each part and piece of it, who had guided its plate tectonics and sparked its weather systems into life, fast-tracked its erosion and seeded its soil with life. But the monkeys burned. All for nothing. It seemed impossible that she had been so close to that grand dream, the spread of life throughout the universe, the diversification of intelligence, the guaranteed survival of Earth's legacy. And then the war came, and Sering's idiocy. Just too soon. How long can we last? Was her question. Doctor, our solar arrays should enable our survival for an indefinite period of time. Although it is possible that external impact or accumulated mechanical defect may eventually result in the cessation of function, there is no known upper limit on our working lifespan. That had probably been intended as a pronouncement of hope. To Kern, it sounded more like a prison sentence. Let me sleep, she told the pod. I require guidance on when to wake you. She laughed at it, the sound of her own voice hideous in the close confines. When the rescue ship arrives, when the monkeys answer, when my undead uploaded self decides. Is that sufficient? I believe I can work within those tolerances, Doctor. I will now prepare you for a return to cold sleep. Sleep. For a long, lonely time. She would return to the tomb, and a simulacrum of herself would stand watch over a silent planet in a silent universe, as the last outpost of the great spacefaring human civilization. Part 2. Pilgrimage. Chapter 2.1. 2,000 Years from Home. Holston Mason started awake into a nightmare of claustrophobia, fighting it down almost as quickly as it hit him. Experience allowed him to recognise where he was, and why that was no cause for alarm, but the old monkey instincts still had their moment of glory, shrieking, "Trapped! Trapped!" in the halls of his mind. Fucking monkeys. He was freezing cold, and enclosed in a space that his body barely fit into, with what felt like 1,000 needles withdrawing themselves from his grey and nerveless skin, and tubes being yanked from more intimate regions, none of it done with much sense of tender care. Business as usual for the suspension chamber. He would like to think that he really hated suspension chambers, but that wasn't exactly an option for any member of the human race right now. For a moment he thought that this was it. He was being woken up, but not released, to be trapped instead behind the frigid glass, unheard and unnoticed on a vast and empty ship of iced corpses heading forever into the nowhere of deep space. The primal claustrophobia jumped him for a second time. He was already fighting to lift his hands, to beat at the transparent cover above him, when the seal hissed, and the dim, undirected light was replaced by the steady glare of the ship's lamps. His eyes barely flinched. The suspension chamber would have been preparing his body for this awakening long before it deigned to spark his mind back to life. Belatedly, he wondered if something had gone wrong. There were a limited number of circumstances in which he would have been revived, after all. He could hear no alarms, though, and the very limited status readout within the chamber had all been safe blue bars, unless that's what's broken, of course. The Ark ship, Gilgamesh, had been built to last a very long time indeed. Using every piece of craft and science that Holston's civilization had been able to wrest from the cold, vacuum-withered hands of their forebears. Even so, had there been an option, nobody would have trusted it. For how could anyone have faith that a machine, any work of the hands of humanity, could last throughout the appalling periods of time that would be required for this journey? "Happy birthday! You're now the oldest man in history," said a sharp voice. "Now get your feet under you, you lazy tosser. We need you. Holston's eyes focused on a face. Nominally a woman's. It was hard, lined, with a bony chin and cheekbones, and her hair the same close crop of stubble as his own. Suspension chambers were not kind to human hair. Issa Lane, chief key crew engineer of the Gilgamesh. He started trying to make some joke about never thinking she'd say she needed him, but he slurred the words and lost it. She understood enough to look at him contemptuously. "Need isn't the same as want, old man. Get up and button your suit. Your arse is hanging out." Feeling like a 100-year-old cripple, he hunched and clambered and swung his way out of the coffin-shaped tank that had been his resting place for... Oldest man in what? Now? Lane's words came back to him with a jolt of realisation. "Hey," he said thickly. "How long? How far out? Are we even clear of the solar system? We must be for her to say that." And as if he could see through the close, confining walls, he had a sudden sense of the vast emptiness that must be out there beyond the hull, a void that no human had plumbed since before the Ice Age, since the millennia-ago days of the old Empire. The key crew suspension room was cramped, barely space for the two of them and the ranks of coffins, his own and two others open and empty, the rest still holding the not-quite corpses of other vital crew, against the need for them to resume an active role aboard ship. Lane threaded her way over to the hatch and swung it open before answering, glancing back over her shoulder with all her mockery gone. 1,837 years, Mason. Or that's what the Gilgamesh says. Holston sat back down on the lip of the suspension chamber, his legs abruptly insufficient to keep him standing up. How's he holding up? Have you... The sentences kept fragmenting in his head. How long have you been up? Have you checked over the cargo? The others?
I've been up for 9 days now while you were being lovingly licked awake, Mason. I've gone over everything. It's all satisfactory. They did a good solid job when they built this boy.
Satisfactory? He sensed the uncertainty in that word. Then everyone's...
Satisfactory in that we have a 4% chamber failure rate amongst the cargo, she told him flatly. For just short of 2 millennia, I think that counts as satisfactory. It could have been worse.
Right. Yes, of course. He got to his feet again and made his way over to her, the floor chilly against his bare skin, trying now to work out if they were accelerating or decelerating, or if the crew section was just spinning about its axis for gravity. Certainly something was keeping him on the floor. If there was some sense that could split hairs between different flavours of ersatz gravity, though, it was one his forebears had somehow failed to evolve. He was trying not to think about what 4% meant, or that the handily impersonal word cargo referred to a very large fraction of the surviving human race. And you need me for what, anyway? Because most of the others were still asleep, and what bizarre set of circumstances could possibly require his presence when most of command, science, security and engineering were still locked in a freezing, dreamless stasis?
There's a signal, Lane told him, watching for his reaction carefully. Yes, I thought that would get you moving.
He was nothing but questions as they negotiated the passage that led through to comms, but Lane just set a punishing pace and ignored him, letting him weave and stumble as his legs tried to betray him with every few steps. Vri Guyen was the third early riser, as Holston had anticipated. Whatever the emergency, it required the Gilgamesh's commander, its chief engineer, and its classicist. But what Lane had said accounted for that neatly. A signal. And out here, what could that mean? Either something wholly alien, or a remnant of the old Empire. Holston's area of expertise.
It's faint and badly distorted. The Gilgamesh took too long, really, to even recognise it for what it was. I need you to see what you can make of it.
Guyen was a thin, small-framed man, with a nose and mouth that both seemed to have been salvaged from a far broader face. Holston recalled his command style as being a mixture of aggressive motivation and good delegating skills. It seemed like only a few days ago that Holston had been under that stern gaze, as he climbed into his suspension chamber. But when he probed his memories to determine just how many days, he uncovered an uncrossable grey area, a dim sensation that his sense of time was out of joint. 2,000 years will do that to you, apparently. Every minute or so, he was struck afresh by the revelation of how ludicrously lucky they all were just to be here. Satisfactory, as Lane had said.
"Where is it coming from, though?" Halston asked. "Is it where we thought it would be?"
Guyon just nodded, his face composed, but Halston felt a thrill of excitement go through him.
"It's there. It was real, all this time."
The Gilgamesh had not just cast itself randomly into the void to escape the end of all that they had left behind. They were one step short of being quite as suicidal as that. They had been following the maps and charts of the old empire, looted from failed satellites, from fragments of ship, from the broken shells of orbital stations containing the void mummified corpses of Earth's former masters. Vacuum and stable orbits had saved them, while the ice was scouring the planet below. And amongst the relics were the star maps, detailing where in the galaxy the ancients had walked. They showed him the signal, as it was distantly received by the Gilgamesh's instruments. It was a relatively short message, repeating interminably. No busy radio chatter of a bustling extrasolar colony. That would surely have been too much to hope for, given the time that had elapsed.
"Maybe it's a warning," Guyon suggested. "If so, and if there's some danger, we need to know."
"And if there's some danger, what precisely do we do about it?" Halston asked quietly. "Can we even change our heading enough now, without hitting the system?"
"We can prepare," Lane said pragmatically. "If it's some cosmic event that we somehow haven't picked up, and that somehow hasn't destroyed the transmitter, then we might have to try and alter course. If it's a plague, or hostile aliens or something, well, it's been a long time, I'll bet. Probably it's not relevant anymore."
"But we have the maps. Worst comes to worst, we can plot a course for the next world,"
Guyon pointed out. "We'll just slingshot past their sun and be on our way."
By then, Halston had stopped paying attention to him and just sat hunched, listening by earpiece to the Gilgamesh's rendition of the signal, looking over visual depictions of its frequency and pattern, calling up reference works from their library. He adjusted the Gilgamesh's interpretation of the signal, passing it through all the known decoding algorithms that long-dead civilization had used. He had done this before plenty of times. All too often, the signal would be encoded beyond the ability of modern cryptography to unpick. At other times, there would be plain speech, but in one of those problem languages that nobody had been able to decipher. He listened and ran his encryptions, and words began to leap out at him, in that formal, antique tongue of a vanished age of wonder and plenty, and an appalling capacity for destruction.
"Imperial Sea," he declared confidently. It was one of the more common of the known languages, and if he could just get his brain working properly, it should be child's play to translate it now he'd cleaned it up. There was a message there, finally opening like a flower to him, spilling out its brief, succinct contents in a language that had died before the ice came.
"What?"
Guyon started angrily, but Halston held up a hand for silence, letting the whole message play again and enjoying his moment of prominence.
"It's a distress beacon," he announced.
"Distress as in... go away?" Lane pressed.
"Distress as in come and get me," Halston told them, meeting their eyes, seeing there the first spark of hope and wonder that he himself felt. "Even if there's no one, and almost certainly there's no one, there will be tech. Functioning tech. Something waiting there for us for thousands of years. Just for us."
For a moment, this revelation was strong enough that their generalized low-level dislike of him almost vanished. They were three shepherds leading their human flock to a new promised land. They were the founding parents of the future. Then Guyon clapped his hands.
"Fine. Good work. I'll have the Gilgamesh wake key personnel in time to start deceleration. We've won our gamble."
No words said for all those left behind, who had not even been given the chance to play, or to wonder about the handful of other Ark ships that had taken different courses, the Earth spitting out the last gobbets of its inhabitants before the rising tide of poison overcame it.
"Back to your slabs, both of you."
There was still at least a century of silent, death-cold travel, between them and the signal's source.
"Give me just half a watch awake," Holston said automatically.
Guyon glared at him, remembering suddenly that he had not wanted Holston among key crew. Too old, too fond of himself, too proud of his precious education.
"Why?"
"Because it's cold, because it's like being dead, because I'm afraid I won't wake up, or that you won't wake me, because I'm afraid." But Holston shrugged easily.
"Time enough to sleep later, isn't there? Let me look at the stars, at least. Just half a watch, and then I'll turn in. Where's the harm?"
Guyon grumbled his contempt at him, but nodded reluctantly.
"Let me know when you go back. Or if you're last man up, then..."
"Turn out the lights. Yes, I know the drill." In truth, the drill was a complex double check of ship's systems, but the Gilgamesh itself did most of the hard stuff. All of key crew were taught how to do it. It was barely more taxing than reading down a list. Monkey work. Guyon stalked off, shaking his head, and Holston cocked an eye towards Lane, but she was already going over the engineering readouts, a professional to the last. Later, though, as he sat in the cupola and watched the alien starfield, 2,000 years from any constellations that his ancestors might have known, she came to join him, and sat with him for a fidgety 15 minutes without saying anything. Neither of them could quite voice the suggestion then, but by raised eyebrow and abortive hand movement, they ended up out of their ship suits and clasped together on the cool floor, whilst all of creation wheeled gently overhead. Chapter 2.2 Earth's Other Children. The name she answers to has both a simple and a complex form. The simple form comprises a series of telegraphed gestures, a precise motion of the palps, conveying limited amount of information. The longer form incorporates a backing of stamping and shivering to add a subtle vibrational subtext to that crude flag-waving, varying with mood and tense, and whether she speaks to a dominant or submissive female, or to a male. The nanovirus has been busy, doing what it can with unexpected material. She is the result of generations of directed mutation, her presence mute witness for all those failures who never bred. Call her Portia. To travel the forest is to travel the high roads, branch to branch, each tree a world in miniature, crossing where the branches touch, now upside down, now right side up, scaling vertical trunks, then leaping where the branches give out, trailing a lifeline, and trusting to the eye and the mind to calculate distance and angle. Portia creeps forwards, judging ranges. Her branch juts out into the void, and she spends a careful minute considering whether she can make the jump to the next, before deciding that she cannot. Above her, the canopy fades out into a network of twigs that can't possibly bear her weight. Portia is far larger than her tiny ancestress, half a metre from fangs to spinnerets, an arachnophobe's nightmare. The support of her exoskeleton is aided by internal cartilage, once used for little more than muscle attachment. Her muscles are more efficient too, and some of them expand and contract her abdomen, drawing air actively over her book lungs rather than just passively taking in oxygen. This permits a boosted metabolism, regulated body temperature, and a life of swift and sustained action. Below is the forest floor, no place to be crossed lightly. There are larger predators than Portia abroad, and although she is confident in her ability to outthink them, that would involve lost time, and dusk is close. She scans her surroundings and considers her options. She has the excellent eyesight of the tiny huntress she evolved from. The great dark orbs of her principal eyes are considerably larger than those of any human. She turns her body to bring her companions into view, trusting to her peripheral eyes to warn her of danger. Bianca, the other female, is still behind at the trunk, watching Portia and willing to trust her judgment. Bianca is larger, but Portia leads, because size and strength have not been their species' most prized assets for a very long time. The third of her party, the male, is lower than Bianca, his legs spread out for balance as he hangs on the tree looking downwards. Possibly he thinks he is keeping watch, but Portia feels he is probably just letting his mind wander. Too bad. She needs him. He is smaller than she. He can jump further and trust to more slender branches. The three of them are out of their territory by 50 days. Theirs is a species given to curiosity. That same ability that allowed their tiny ancestors to create a mental map of their environs has become the ability to imagine, to ask what is beyond the forest. Portia's people are born explorers. She raises her palps, white side out, and signals, "Come here." No need to give him his name. Females do not refer to males by name. He catches the motion in his lateral eyes and twitches. He's always twitching. Afraid of his own shadow. Wretched creature. She has distinct opinions on him, and more complimentary ones concerning Bianca. Her world consists of over 100 individuals, mostly females, with whom she enjoys carefully maintained relationships. The nanovirus has been driving her species hard towards a communal existence. Although her brain is decidedly smaller than a human's, just as the original Portia could use her minuscule knot of neurons to accomplish remarkable things, this distant daughter has an impressive ability to